This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. On the Westminster Hour, my panel tonight, two people enjoying their last few days as MPs, for now at least. On Wednesday, when Parliament's formally dissolved, they'll become candidates in the general election, just like all the others, fighting for every vote. They are Emily Thornberry, Shadow Foreign Secretary, whose North London seat neighbours Jeremy Corbyn's and their close political allies too. And Emily, you were hearing that news there about Matteo Renzi in Italy. It's just come through. What you were reacting to it?
Well, it's just all very odd. When I went out to Italy, they seemed to be facing all kinds of challenges. They had the referendum, which they wanted to make major changes to the constitution. Renzi had said that he'd stand down if he lost the referendum. So I was asking, well, if the Prime Minister stands down, presumably you'll have to have a general election. There's problems with the banks. And they were saying, no, everything will be fine, Emily. We're used to this insecurity. There's actually sort of security within our insecurity. They lost the referendum. Renzi resigned. But it looks like, and they didn't have a general election because they had already, in anticipation of getting the right results in the referendum, changed the rules for the election of the second house. So they weren't able to have an election. And Renzi has just been re-elected as leader of the main party. So presumably he's back being prime minister. So they were right.
So politics can surprise.
Yeah.
Oliver Dowden's here as well, a Hertfordshire Conservative who came into Parliament at the last election. Perhaps you weren't expecting to be out on the campaign trail again quite so soon. And before that, you spent 5 years in Downing Street as a close advisor to David Cameron. And tell me, have you got tired yet of the slogans? Please don't engage in too many tonight.
Now, I won't be engaging in slogans, but I will be making the point that there is a clear choice between the strong and stable leadership of Theresa May and the coalition of chaos from the Labour Party.
No more. That is it. We are also joined by Professor Philip Cowley from Queen Mary University of London. And what he doesn't know about British politics, elections and political parties really isn't worth knowing. We are companions on the election overnight programmes, and I always turn to him for advice. And you've written a great analysis of the British general election of 2015, so you've got to do it all over again, haven't you, Phil?
Slightly earlier than planned. I was a great fan of fixed-term parliaments for precisely this reason, and filled with horror at the thought of having to write another book. My only plea to any election candidates out there is keep a diary. However tired you are, however exhausted you are, even if it's only one line, even if it's only everyone loves Tim Farron or whatever it is that has come up on the doorstep, keep a diary and then let me see it when it's over.
To help you write your next account. And hot off the campaign trail, The Times' deputy political editor, Sam Coates. Sam, you obviously are watching all the parties. Give us a few standout moments from the past week.
Well, I suppose up at number one is the hunt for Labour voters. Talk to Tory MPs, talk to journalists, even talk to Labour MPs, and they are struggling in some cases to find Labour voters in the kind of areas that you want to. This could be a really cataclysmic election for Labour, one that redefines the political map. In at number two, if it does change the way that politics is done because there is a seismic change, then this will be the election that delivers us Theresa May unshackled. But hand on heart, I don't know what Theresa May unshackled looks like without the problems of an inherited manifesto, a cabinet that she didn't entirely want to appoint, with MPs in her own image, all grateful to her. What does that look like? In at number three, Brexit means Brexit, but only on Theresa May's terms in this election. We've got Brexit, but not really any debate about the biggest thing that this country has to do in this election campaign, which is that UK-EU free trade deal. Today we've been hearing it's going to be harder than we thought. It hasn't properly come up in the election campaign. Maybe that will change. In at number four, the big figure, one of the big figures this week was Tim Farron. Poor Tim Farron. The Liberal Democrats could stand to benefit enormously from this election, standing as they are with their distinct pro-European, anti-Brexit stance. But we ended the week talking about Tim Farron sniffing a spaniel. Having started the week talking about his position on gay sex, he ended it thinking it wasn't a sin, of course. Today he said that he's a bit of a Eurosceptic. All this somersaulting has left many of his core voters, I suspect, slightly flummoxed. And finally, we are also witnessing the UKIP hokey-cokey. Beneath the hood of the churn in this election is likely to be a big switch from UKIP voters in 2015 who didn't quite get on with David Cameron's brand of conservative and didn't quite like the sort of poshy associations of George Osborne's type of running the economy and are going to potentially come back in their droves to the Conservative Party. If that happens, it doesn't look like Paul Nuttall is doing much to stand in their way. He took a week to decide whether or not he would stand. And I think that that really sums up where that party is at the moment.
Well, there we are, your moments of the week. I was going to ask my two MPs here for their moments of the week, but I think there are two issues there I'd really love you to respond to. And Emily, first of all, Sam says he's been looking for Labour voters, that his feeling is that these elections are going to be cataclysmic for Labour. Give us a sense of how you're finding reaction on the doorstep.
Well, the first thing is my moment of the week was Ruth Davidson meeting Theresa May. Obviously, she's not been meeting any voters herself, only party members. And there's this lovely clip of someone who's being held back in a forest where he's trying to meet her, shouting, "Hen, meet the people, meet the people." Now, I've been meeting the people. I've been to Manchester and Oldham and Sheffield and Bristol and Bath and Islington and Drewsbury. I even went to Gibraltar in the last couple of weeks, and I can meet Labour voters. So maybe, Sam, next time I meet a Labour voter, maybe you should come with me tomorrow to Reading or to Southampton, is where I'm going tomorrow. And
what's
you'll meet
your
some
feeling,
Labour
though, about
there.
How the vote's going? Because, you know, the polls, we know sometimes they can be wrong, and Phil will talk about this later, but they're not looking great for Labour, are they, at the moment?
I think that the election is at a very early stage. A lot of people that I meet haven't even kind of, we may have all clocked the election. We may all be thinking and breathing elections at the moment. But I think people who have lives going on out there have only just started to kind of think about it, let alone pick up the dreadful Theresa May slogans. So I think that in the next few weeks, people will begin to focus. And obviously the battle is how the election is being told to them and the lines and the narratives and everything else. And to a certain extent, that's what the Westminster Village is fighting over at the moment. But the important thing is that the public understand this is a general election. There are a lot of issues they need to decide.
Sam Coates?
If, Emily, I may just for a moment out-cynic you. Labour's attack against Theresa May at the moment seems to concentrate on the fact that she's, quote-unquote, not meeting ordinary voters. I don't think that David Cameron did that, and I don't think it did him much harm in 2015.
I think do you know what the harm is? If you don't listen to the people, if you don't listen to what people think and you don't learn from them, then you're a rubbish politician.
Oliver, there is a point about meeting the people. Theresa May has said she won't engage in TV debates. Some are saying that's because Jeremy Corbyn, actually, when he meets the people and he engages in debates with the public, he does pretty well. But what's your view of what Sam was saying about Theresa May unshackled? What does that look like?
Well, first of all, on the debates, Theresa May debates Jeremy Corbyn across a dispatch box every week. I don't think she's got a huge amount to fear from him.
It's not supposed to be a debate.
But also, I must say, I was involved in the TV debate process quite extensively in 2010. And I think the problem with that was the whole election campaign was taken over by TV debates. It consisted of anticipation and build-up to the TV debate and then post-match analysis. And they had three of those and none of the issues got discussed.
Did David Cameron regret those TV debates?
I think we all regretted the fact that the issues didn't come out. And one thing I know about the Prime Minister is she wants to concentrate on the issues. And this is what she's been doing. She's actually a doorstep campaigner out and about talking about those.
I thought in the TV debates they did come out and there was questioning.
Well, I think that if you look back on the TV debate process, it was all about the process rather than the actual substance of it. And I think that was something we felt was lacking from that.
Phil Kelly.
Well, the thing that the TV debates did in 2010 was kill off the press conferences, which used to be a standard part of British general elections. Every morning you'd have a Conservative press conference, a Lib Dem press conference, a Labour press conference, during which there would be a sort of fairly detailed exchange of policy. Those were killed off in 2010. There was no point having them because the TV debates took over. They didn't come back in 2015. And now what's happened is the TV debates have gone as well, and there's nothing to replace them. There's just this sort of vacuum, which I think is one of the reasons why this is going to feel like a very policy-light general election.
Ah, well, you bring me on to my next point, because at the moment, without the party manifestos, we are all left scrutinising the utterances of the party leaders for any clues at all to what we might expect. Now, Labour has made a few policy announcements. We know they made them over Easter. Some of them have come out in the past week. But from the Conservatives, Oliver, it has to be said, promises are few at this stage. So we're seizing on the tried and tested failure to rule out formula. And we were doing that this morning. Today, Theresa May failed to rule out scrapping the Conservatives' so-called triple lock on pensions, which promises that state pensions will continue to rise in line with wages, inflation, or by 2.5%, whichever is highest. Same thing when it came to that other triple lock on taxes that David Cameron pledged not to raise, income tax, VAT or national insurance. Here was Theresa May talking to Andrew Marr this morning on BBC One.
We have absolutely no plans to increase the level of tax, but I'm also very clear that I don't want to make specific proposals on taxes unless I'm absolutely sure that I can deliver on those. But it is would be my intention as a Conservative government and as a Conservative Prime Minister to reduce the taxes on working families.
So, Oliver, she went on to say only on VAT was she definitive that that would not go up. So that's going to stay, what, at 20% or less until 2022, but no such promise for David Cameron's flagship tax lock promise. You know, he made it, didn't he, before the last election. It's going.
Well, actually, David Cameron's flagship tax promise was to cut taxes for ordinary working people by raising the personal allowance. And that's something we did spectacularly well.
That was a Lib Dem pledge, wasn't it? That was brought that, in that, with that, the Lib Dems.
Well, that
government.
Was a promise that was in the Conservative manifesto in 2015 and we continued to deliver on. And what that's actually delivered is a tax cut for 30 million working people. For somebody on the basic rate of tax, that's a £1,000 tax cut.
All right,
that is the record
that
we'll be taking to the public.
But what about the idea of saying, OK, let's move away from that promise on something like national insurance? Is that because the budget proved so problematic? There was the promise made on national insurance which had to be retracted. Would you like to go ahead with those sorts of rises now?
Well, I think what's absolutely clear from the Conservatives in government is that we have constantly cut people's taxes and cut the taxes for working people. And if you contrast that with the record of the Labour Party...
Could you just answer me on the national insurance, though? I mean, is now the time to sort of ditch that pledge so you've got a bit more flexibility?
Well, let's have a look at the manifesto that will be coming out in days. But what I'm sure the manifesto will show is that the Conservative Party is committed to cutting people's taxes and we have an excellent record of doing it. We've taken 4 million people out of tax altogether, the lowest paid, someone working 35 hours a week now on the minimum wage, pays no tax at all. That's for me, working in Downing Street, that was the key thing, lifting people out of tax altogether.
And you give credit to the Lib Dems for that, do you? Because it was their idea originally.
It was actually a Conservative policy that was delivered. The Conservatives found the money and the Conservatives promised it in 2015.
Whose policy was it to increase VAT?
Well, I think you'll find that the last Labour government managed to increase VAT, if I remember correctly.
Wasn't it right that you promised that you weren't going to raise VAT, but then you did? You know, and that affects the poorest people. And you've been cutting tax credits. That's a way of cutting tax as well, isn't it? I mean, of going the other way when it comes to tax.
For somebody who's working 35 hours a week on the minimum wage, they no longer pay any tax at all.
And they're not getting the tax credits.
And secondly, we are introducing the national living wage.
All right.
Two things that the Labour Party failed to do in 13 years in office.
All right, you two. I think we will disagree on this. You certainly will disagree between you. Emily, Labour has said it won't raise VAT or raise taxes for workers, that taxes will fall on the top end. Jeremy Corbyn said very much at the top end. When will we get a sense of what that figure will be? We know that John McDonnell originally said maybe people are above £70,000. You said, well, look, for people in London, £70,000 isn't necessarily top end. What's your thinking of what the figure will be?
So, you know, what with me not being the Shadow Chancellor and us not having published our manifesto yet, I'm really not going to be able to help you on that.
Rough idea.
I can tell you what John has said so far, which is that we're not increasing VAT and we are not going to increase income tax on low and middle incomes. And we've made that quite clear and we've come out and said it. And when you say nobody's saying anything on policies, I mean, today, for example, we also made 20 pledges on how we were going to improve employment rights. We made pledges on education. Actually, actually the Labour Party is pretty rich in terms of the amount of policies that we're coming out with.
But it's we just need that we're to not wait. Able. We need yeah. to wait for the manifesto.
And
you're
what
saying
we
for
what
that
we want
figure.
What we want to do in relation to the manifesto is we want it to be there so that it can be looked at line by line. It will all be costed, and we've said that we would like, as we did last time, the Office of Budget Responsibility to look at our manifesto and to look at the Tory manifesto, so that an independent body can say yes, it adds up.
Phil and Sam, how important is taxation in this election? Are these the issues that get people going? You know, what's top of the hit list when it comes to people's concerns?
Well, I think what's interesting about taxation is not just the individual pledges that politicians make. I'm not sure that the tax lock proposal that's about to be dropped by Theresa May that caused so much difficulty for Philip Hammond was in of itself a sort of mighty proposal. But what tax does is to signal to voters roughly whether or not the politician that they are listening to is on their side. So if a politician talks about clamping down on taxes for people in a certain income bracket, they'll make a judgment about whether that politician is for them or for somebody else. So I think that taxes narrowly, I think people think about tax narrowly in terms of whether or not they're going to be better or worse off, which is a very important question when people go into the ballot box. But also I think people use it as an indicator as to whether that politician is on their side or not. And that has one of the dynamics that has traditionally slightly played in favour of the Conservatives.
And Phil, what about the pension triple lock? How important has that been? And if that's ditched, do you think it could be harmful to the Conservatives?
Well, I mean, you know, one of the golden rules of politics is, you know, there's lots of older voters and they vote. So, you know, there's a reason why politicians generate largesse towards older voters. What I think actually is most interesting about both actually taxation and maybe pensions is that the Conservatives feel able to ditch some of these policies. I mean, the reason they were in the manifesto 2 years ago was because they were seeing the election as incredibly tight, and however difficult these things were then to deliver, there was an electoral benefit to them. The fact that Theresa May thinks she might be able to get away with ditching these seems to me an indication that she thinks she has enough scope in order to do so.
Oliver, the idea of dropping the pension triple lock, are you in favour of that?
Well, the thing to remember about the pension triple lock is that it's a way of demonstrating our commitment to pensioners. And actually that has resulted in over £1,000 increase in the basic rate of the state pension. You would contrast with the 75p rises we saw under Labour. So what I'll be looking for is that commitment to pensioners. And the exact form that takes is something that we'll look for in the manifesto.
So that but could changed. That could be changed.
I think it's very important.
Your gut tells you that it could be changed.
My gut tells me that we need to maintain our commitment to pensioners, maintain increasing pensions as we have done previously. We saw that with the rises we saw over the last Parliament, record rises in the state pension. It's very important that we give people that dignity and security in retirement. But more important than that, to have the strong economy that allows us to pay for it. And that's what I'll be looking for in the manifesto. That's the plans for the strong economy, which will pay for higher pensions for people.
All right. The Lib Dem leader, Tim Farron, told the I newspaper yesterday that his party can replace Labour as the main opposition force because Jeremy Corbyn's party, he says, is locked in a death spiral. Although the Lib Dems were virtually wiped out at the last election, he insisted that the extraordinary flux in Western democracies could deliver a tide of seats for his party. Now, here he is making a similar point on the Mar show this morning.
We have a Labour Party that has held Theresa May's hand as they jumped off the cliff edge to a hard Brexit. And this is an important moment. So for young people, people voted Remain, but also those people who voted Leave and think, nevertheless, the Prime Minister is taking us in a wrong direction. The Liberal Democrats are offering you the chance to change the future of this country.
Emily, do you think Labour's missed a trick by not promising a second referendum on the final deal? You know, by promising a clear alternative to Theresa May's views on Brexit?
My view immediately after the referendum is the same as my view now. I campaigned to remain in the European Union. I wanted us to remain in the European Union, but we lost the referendum. And we had to accept that. And we had to accept the instructions that we had been given by the British people. And we have to go in good faith into those negotiations because there are a number of decisions that need to be made. And what we needed to do as an opposition that had 100 less MPs that had lost the referendum was to make sure that they reported regularly, which is what we wanted them to do and they agreed to. We got them to commit to what it was that their plan was. And to be honest, well, it didn't go so well, even though they published a white paper. But to be honest, what they did was they hoovered up every aspiration, every promise, every hope that everybody has in relation to leaving the European Union and published it in a white paper with 666 different promises in it. So we then pinned them down to six and said, these six here, we like these. Mm-hmm. And if you do this, we will vote for it. But if you don't, then we won't. If you don't pass our test, and what we need to do on behalf of the whole country, not just on behalf of 52% or on 48%, we're not picking sides, is we need to be able to leave the European Union in a way that will help the whole country, which in our view is that we leave, but we remain close because it's up, because the most important thing is that we look after the safety and security of our citizens, but the second is about our economy.
Do you know what, though? It's the nuance, isn't it? And Sam, I mean, you've covered the announcements. You were watching Keir Starmer making Labour's Brexit announcement this week. And it's really whether voters will grasp the nuance between the two parties. You know, the Lib Dems have made a very clear commitment.
They are going to be very different. Do you know what? They absolutely haven't. Because they used to be the party that was against Brexit, and now they seem to be the party that seems to be...
Well, we're looking at today's policies, aren't we?
Yeah, no, no. This is a shift over 2 weeks, right? 2 weeks ago, they were the party that shot their bolt and they were fighting Brexit. Now they say they're in favour of Brexit because they're after the seats in the South West, which is really Brexity. They want to be in favour of Brexit, but now they say they want a soft Brexit. That is a shift.
All right.
And frankly, they're trying to climb into
Sam
our bed
Coates.
And kick us out of it.
Sam Coates and then Oliver, yeah.
I do think that Labour's position on Brexit is complicated. Even today, you had a good example of that with Clive Lewis coming out in favour of a second referendum in order to have another go at giving the people a vote about the deal.
Well, Clive's a backbencher, and he had to resign because he didn't agree with Labour policy.
I think the difficulty that Labour faces is how to sort of keep both wings of their coalition on side. Labour has a very wide coalition of voters, and it needs to appeal to people both on the Brexit side and the Remain side.
It's not a good thing because we want to represent the whole country.
All right, final one on this from
Oliver.
Well,
I'm afraid this is precisely the problem. There is complete confusion as to Labour's position. You've got Clive Lewis, Rachel Maskell both saying they want to have a second referendum.
A
lack of clarity on this. This is what you're going to have. You have this unclear position from both the Liberal Democrats and Labour. It's only the Conservatives who actually have got that strength and stability, and that's why the Prime Minister wants this mandate, to be able to get the best deal through, because you can see with Lib Dems and Labour what the alternative is.
Final quick point from Sam.
Well, Oliver, if you want to sell me the Conservative Theresa May plan for Brexit, I'd be grateful.
Yeah, we'd
grateful
all love to hear it. Yeah.
Look at the white paper, Sam.
Right.
Make my point very well.
Parliament officially dissolves this week for the general election. But some of us have a shorter time to wait than others before we get to mark an X with a stubby pencil. This Thursday, there are local elections across Scotland, Wales and England, as well as the election of six new metro mayors in Greater Manchester, West Midlands, Liverpool, West of England, Cambridge and Peterborough and Tees Valley. Professor Phil Cowley, areas to watch then on Thursday?
Well, I'm tempted to say all of them, because I think there is going to, out of that list, there's going to be a lot of really interesting contest, and I slightly feel for them in the sense that they've been overshadowed by the general election, and otherwise we would be covering these elections in quite a lot of detail, I think. I mean, individual places to watch: Nottinghamshire, Derbyshire, Glasgow, Cardiff, the metro mayoral contest in the West Midlands, which should be safe for Labour but may well not be. And what's interesting about almost all of those is they are all places where we're watching the extent to which Labour is in trouble. And so, actually, if I had to pick a broader geographic area, it would be Wales in general. I want to see whether the opinion polling, which we had earlier this week, which showed the Conservatives way ahead of Labour in Wales, 10 points ahead of Labour in Wales, is replicated in these local elections, and whether Labour is actually in trouble. Now, my suspicion for what it's worth, is that Labour will do badly in these elections, but they will not do as badly as their current Westminster polling figure suggests, which will send a very mixed message, because it will allow some people to say, I told you the polls are wrong, we're doing better than the polls indicate. I suspect that actually that's to do with voters being willing to split their vote between local contests and the national picture. But we will only know that for sure when we come to June.
I'm going to come back and get a few more points from you in a moment. But you mentioned Wales. Voters throughout Wales will be going to the polls on Thursday, and the Welsh Nationalist Plaid Cymru will be hoping to make advances, as their group leader at Westminster, Hal Williams, has been telling me.
We've got nearly 600 candidates. We're standing, you know, all over the country, and we do control a number of local authorities already. So our hopes are high, I think. There are a couple where we think we'll improve to the extent that possibly we'll take control, and we'll retain the ones that we have. And generally, I think we will increase our number of councillors, including, by the way, surprisingly for some people, I think, in Cardiff, where our ambition is very high indeed there. When I was a student there many years ago, we scarcely got any votes at all. And now, you know, we are in serious contention in the local elections in Cardiff.
Isn't Plaid Cymru, though, unashamedly pro-EU? And aren't you then going against the tide of the majority of Welsh people who voted to leave? I mean, 17 council areas in Wales voted to leave. Only 5 voted remain. 29 general election constituencies voted to leave and 11 voted remain.
Certainly our position has always been pro-European, unashamedly so. But possibly not the European Union that we've had in the past. I don't want to stray into that debate now. We've always been very ambitious for Wales's place in the world. But these are local elections. However much they're overshadowed by the general debate, people will be looking at how services are provided, how does Plaid do in providing health, social services and education and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think we have a very, very good record, not only in providing those services, but also in providing them efficiently.
Part of your record has involved working with Labour in government at Cardiff Bay. You've got Labour into power, you've passed their budget. Would you rule out working with Labour at Westminster if it meant uniting in a stronger opposition against the Conservatives?
Well, what we'll do is we'll seek advantage for our communities, for our country, where we can find it. Now, I don't think that that in any way implies that we'd go into any sort of coalition or long-term arrangements with Labour.
We're here to change things. Even though you've worked with them before?
Well, we had a very successful period in governments with the Labour Party. Most commentators recognise that the period when we were working with the Labour Party is probably the best period of Welsh governments from Cardiff that there's been.
If that's the case, then people will vote for you in droves, won't they, to try and get you back into government?
Well,
but
I
hasn't
seriously
happened
hope
yet.
That they will. We'll have to persuade them. Our vote has been, I suppose, stuck is the word. I think we're wrongly seen as being the party for one part of Wales, and we've always looked to break through in the south and the east. And we have done so in the past.
If your party remains stuck, as you describe it, do you think Leanne Wood should stand down as leader if you don't make progress in these elections?
Elections are sprints, but the ambitions that we have for our country is a marathon. We were established in 1925, and we have been winning parliamentary elections since 1966. But it is a long-term project. We are looking for our national emancipation, and we've had lots of success over the last 40-odd years. So you can judge us by how we do in the sprints, but I also think you need to look at how we're doing in the long term.
And you're happy for Leanne Wood to stay long term?
Yeah, I mean, it's a job that she's been doing very efficiently, representing us and getting us a very good profile, not only in Wales, of course, but also across the UK. She's doing a very good job indeed. It's her job as long as she wants it, I think.
That's Hal Williams, the Plaid Cymru group leader at Westminster. So we're talking about the elections on Thursday. Phil was telling us about that situation in Wales. There have been predictions that Labour will lose hundreds of seats across Britain. Sam Coates, what are you hearing about areas to watch for indicators?
Well, I think Professor Phil is, of course, always right. But what I'll be looking at on Thursday, Scotland, Glasgow, could Labour lose that bastion? Could it even lose Edinburgh? Those are the two big Scottish seats, council seats that I'll be looking for. Then the West Midlands as well. I think that as Phil says, it is absolutely overwhelmingly dominated by Labour constituencies. So if Andy Street, the former John Lewis boss, can grab that, running a campaign where he hasn't branded himself a Conservative, he's just used the John Lewis green and gone around the region collecting votes. If he can snatch that away from Tom Watson ally Sean Simon, then that would be quite something. But these Metro mayors, it's worth just pausing for 1 second to realise that we are about to get a new layer of democracy in this country called Metro Mayors. There are 6 elections on Thursday, and they're going to be, as it were, clumps of councils clustered together with one figure directly elected overseeing the work, given some powers, probably more over town over time. And we haven't given them a great deal of attention. Up in Tyne Tees, there's one Tory candidate, his first name's Ben, I can't remember his surname, who is actually promising to nationalise the local airport because he never thought he'd be elected. Now there's been this great big tide in the election. Is he going to have to find the money?
So if Labour were to win these mayoral elections in an area like Manchester or Liverpool, does that set up a power base, an effective Labour power base that would challenge a Conservative-led government if the Conservatives win this election?
Well, look, I think the experience in London has been quite instructive here. Mayoralties do 2 things. First of all, they have some direct power. Now, in the case of mayoralties, not a huge amount. We still remain quite a centralised country. But what do they really do? They provide a gigantic bully pit for politicians of stature to exercise the power to beat politicians at a national level around the head when they don't like what they're doing. That, I suspect, is going to be more important than the partial transport levers, the minor regeneration powers, and in some cases, as in Manchester, where Andy Burnham is standing and is likely to win a little bit of power over health.
There are other candidates
available, but for some of them, they have powers over some area. But really, I think it's going to be the bully pit that the job provides.
Phil?
I think that's right. And I think partly, again, because of the general election swamping this, we've not been talking about this very much, and we would be normally. I was struck today earlier on one of the telly programmes. John McDonnell said, when asked about Labour's position in the polls, he said 2 things. The first is we don't believe the polls, and the second is the polls are getting better. And now, actually, I think I kind of knew what he was getting at in terms of, we may not know the absolute position, but we're interested in the trend. And there are some signs that the position is getting slightly better for Labour. 4 polls out today, and all of them have the Labour position slightly improved on where we were a week ago. So, the locals will be a great insight into whether the position is as bad as we think.
Will there be read across, as we like to say?
Well, there's read across, but you always have to bear in mind that people vote differently and increasingly vote differently in local elections to general elections. So you can take some read across from these. And if, for example, in the Midlands, Labour do not win the Metro Mayor, that will be a terrible result, because it should be a fairly straightforward, nailed-on result for the Labour Party.
Are you looking forward to Friday morning, Emily? I mean, last year, I remember Jeremy Corbyn was saying, we hung on. You didn't lose as many seats as were predicted. But this time, I mean, if we are talking about wipeout in Scotland, losing more than 100 seats in England, are you braced?
Yeah, I remember this is a bit sort of deja vu, isn't it? Because last time, if you or 5 of us sit at a table like this, I'd have be full of pundits and politicians from other parties saying that Labour was going to get wiped out, and we didn't. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Oliver, in the West Midlands, as Sam mentioned, there's a mayoral battle there with Andy Street standing for the Conservatives against a well-established Labour candidate, Sean Simon. What's your reading of how that campaign is going?
Well, I think Andy Street's an excellent candidate. Actually, it's a classic example of the Conservatives having somebody who's got real life experience out there, having run John Lewis so successfully against a Labour candidate who was a former MP. But what I've seen certently my experience during this campaign so far is 2 things. The first is really Labour voters are very, very reluctant to come out and support the Labour Party, not just because of Jeremy Corbyn, but also you get this sense that the Labour Party has moved away from their values, whether it's over the army or Trident. They just don't feel the Labour Party is standing for it.
Well, and secondly, they might say that to you, of course. Sam, you wanted to come in on the West Midlands.
All I'll say is A bit of me wonders whether the Westminster Village has got the expectations set wrong on the West Midlands. There is this presumption that Andy Street may just, with his John Lewis background, may just have it in the bag. But he has run quite a, how can we put it, bold campaign without the word Conservative on his backdrop, just by doing having green banners and hoping that people knew about his John Lewis background, which, to be honest, wasn't in any piece of literature. Quite whether that works against a very strongly tribal West Midlands Labour heartland, I don't yet know.
Very briefly,
everybody keeps saying this is a heartland. I have to say, I've been involved in the West Mids campaign, and it's certainly not one that we have taken for granted. It is absolutely one where we think that we need to work really hard, and indeed are doing so. So we're not taking anything for granted at all in the West Mids. And actually, you know, this is one that we know we have to work really hard at. It is difficult, West Mids.
Phil,
I want to pick up on Sam's point about branding, because one of the things that really struck me this week was the literature for the general election started to arrive through people's letterboxes. And I have been struck looking at Labour MPs' literature. It's not quite on the same level, there is some red in there, and occasionally the word Labour features. What is really striking is the extent to which Labour incumbent MPs are talking about their record as an MP.
Well, that's what people want to know about. Not saying we're Labour MPs is nonsense.
No. I said explicitly, they do use the word Labour, and there is some red, but there's a lot about the MP fighting for the area. There's almost never a mention of Jeremy Corbyn. There's almost never a mention of a Labour government and what a Labour government will do. And that's because those MPs are fighting a defensive campaign based on their incumbency.
There are a number of MPs who I've spoken to who say that they won't have Jeremy Corbyn's picture on their literature. Well, that's good. That's good. And he'll be happy to hear that. But there are plenty of others who aren't. Sam, very quickly, and then we move on.
The counterpoint to that, the Conservative campaign, particularly at the national level, absolutely using Theresa May's name at every opportunity. They want this to be her victory, her mandate, her authority. They think it's popular, but they also then want to use it so she can railroad through her authority after June the 8th.
We don't, of course, have prime ministerial direct elections. These are still elections as they were. It's not a presidential system yet. Only a couple of months ago, voters in the constituencies of Stoke-on-Trent Central and Copeland chose two new MPs for themselves in by-elections, which were briefly the focus of huge political interest. And the results were indeed significant, as Labour held off the challenge from UKIP in Stoke, but succumbed to the Tories in the West Cumbria seat. Now, though, with a snap general election, they've got to do it all again. And John Beazley's been to Stoke to test the water there.
Snell, Gareth, Labour Party, 7,800.
It was meant to be the final word. The voters of Stoke Central had selected Labour's Gareth Snell to represent them in Parliament until May 2020. But that's not how things worked out.
We're going to do canvassing from 10:30.
Yeah, I've asked Andy to come in from 10, but maybe I'll ask him to come in from
Britain's
half nine.
Newest MP had planned a short family holiday for early June. The change of plan, like a bolt from the blue.
A huge shock. I certainly wasn't expecting to be fighting a general election this quickly after the by-election, but this is where we are.
And this comes as you were just beginning to get your feet under the table at the Palace of Westminster.
Yeah, I mean, there were still parts of it that were completely alien to me, but I'd finally started to at least find the way between my office and the chamber unaided. I still was in the process of appointing staff, which I've had to put on hold because obviously I can't appoint people to a role when I may not have a job myself to come back to. And then I had to stop and start again.
And voters too can be forgiven a sense of déjà vu. Counting the last general election, the EU referendum and the by-election, June the 8th will mark their fourth trip to the polls in 2 years.
So I think we're all a bit sick of it, to be honest with you. Here we go again. All the propaganda, all the backstabbing each other and the politicians.
How did you feel when you heard that Theresa May was calling a general election now so soon after the recent by-election?
Happy, because I don't think Theresa May is going to be good for our government. I think Labour should be in.
I'm all up for it if it means we get somebody decent in. And I'm up for Brexit, so I'm quite happy with Maggie Thatcher.
Theresa May,
yeah.
The Prime Minister says she's seeking a strong mandate to negotiate our exit from the European Union. Gareth Snell says he'll be campaigning on the local implications.
We're going to be talking about a Brexit that works for the Potteries. We're going to be focusing on the needs of our NHS, the needs of our education system, what more do we need to do to support social care. We're going to be talking about how we protect jobs and skills, how we help the ceramic industry. Obviously, how people vote in this election can change how government is operated. The by-election really didn't have that effect on the bigger scale, but now there's so much more to play for.
The by-election was a high-stakes contest for UKIP. In a seat where voters strongly favoured leaving the EU, the party leader Paul Nuttall had hoped to win. He came second. So what went wrong? Mick Harold will be standing for UKIP this time.
Wrong candidate. We should have gone with a local candidate, obviously. It didn't help the fact the media assassinated Paul's character, the Ellsbury event and certain things about his PhD and the fact he wasn't a professional footballer. These things didn't help.
I met Mick Harold in the lounge of the solid Victorian-era North Staffordshire Hotel, a statue of the pottery's most famous industrialist, Josiah Wedgwood, standing just outside the window.
It's a place I actually worked in years ago. I worked here as a silver service waiter.
That wasn't long after Britain joined the common market. Now the UK is leaving the EU. What's left for UKIP to campaign on at this election?
We'll be talking about some local issues. You know, obviously, we need to get investment into Stoke-on-Trent. I mean, obviously, immigration will be talked about because immigration is an issue in Stoke-on-Trent. You know, the wages have been driven down. We need to get wages up, and the fact is we've flooded the area with immigrants is not helping.
Third place at the by-election went to the Conservatives, only just behind UKIP. I've come to the long disused site of the old bus station in Hanley to meet David Evans, one of seven Conservative city councillors. It seems an odd place to find a touch of Hollywood glamour.
We had a film shot on the old bus station not so long ago with Gemma Arterton and Glenn Close, which was a zombie film, I believe. But the director, I think, came from Burton, so he was relatively local, so I think he knew the site from that.
The zombies have now been banished. The area is being rebuilt as a new shopping centre, part of regeneration plans from a coalition of independents, Tories and one UKIP member which ousted Labour from power on the council in 2015.
What I would say to people is actually vote for change and actually vote for the strong leadership we need, not just as a country but as a city, and make sure our voice is heard.
Difficult though, isn't it, to pull off the message vote for change when you're actually the government?
It is, but we haven't been the MPs here in Stoke-on-Trent at all. The fact that we are such a deprived area is, in my mind, a testament to 60 years of Labour leadership in this city. And actually, over the last 2 years, the Conservatives now form part of the ruling coalition on the council. So what we need to do now is to tell people, spread the message that actually Conservatives on the council are pushing for the things this city needs. And actually, if you get us into government and get us back into Westminster with representation for the Conservatives in Stoke-on-Trent, then we can push that message here and make sure that we thrive the way we deserve to.
This afternoon, the Conservatives chose another of their leading city councillors, Dan Jellyman, as their candidate in Stoke-on-Trent Central. But having voted only 2 months ago, will voters be open to persuasion from anyone to change their minds?
I voted UKIP last time. Nigel Farage isn't going to be there. So it's basically Labour and it's basically Conservative. It's going to be a very, very difficult, in my mind, who are you going to vote for.
Who are you voting for in the election?
I'm not sure yet. I'm definitely not voting for Jeremy Corbyn.
No?
Nope.
Have you voted Labour before?
Yes, unfortunately, when Blair got in. Now, I will never vote for Labour in my life again.
Though I can see that for the first time in a long time, there's a lot of sense behind Theresa May's reasoning. I was brought up so entrenched in Labour culture that I just can't bring... It will be a step too far for me to vote Conservative.
The kind of voter there, perhaps, that the Lib Dems might hope to attract.
My name's Tony Finney. I am the chair of the local Liberal Democrat Party in Stoke-on-Trent.
The Lib Dems came fourth in the by-election, and with voters here heavily pro-Brexit, their prospects might not appear too rosy. Surveying the scene from this town centre coffee shop, Tony Finney disagreed.
Liberal Democrats are the only major party that are against Brexit, so I think we are bound to sort of take the lead on that. And I think the lessons that we learned from the by-election campaign were that there are people out there in the constituencies that do support remaining in the EU, or at least having the second referendum. So I think we are really the flag bearers on that.
You might be the flag bearers, but if Labour, for example, have candidates who are just as in favour of remaining as you are, wouldn't it be more sensible to work with them?
Not necessarily. I think we have our unique sort of selling point, and I think we will campaign on that basis.
And since we spoke to Tony, we've heard that the Lib Dems too have now chosen their candidate. His name is Peter Andreas. So, a wide choice of parties, a varied range of issues, a volatile electorate and a hefty dose of voter fatigue. All reasons why no one is taking the result for granted here in Stoke Central. But at least the seat itself has had a reprieve. It was due to disappear before 2020 in the planned boundary changes. Because of this snap election, there will be a member for Stoke-on-Trent Central for at least one more parliament.
A snapshot there from Stoke-on-Trent Central, and John Beazley recorded that piece before the names of all the candidates are known. There will be a full list of all the candidates standing in that Stoke-on-Trent Central seat. Indeed, all the constituencies throughout the UK on the BBC website once nominations close a little bit later in May. And of course, you'll find as well lots and lots of information about local and mayoral elections, as we've been discussing, on that BBC website as well. We're going to get the papers in just a sec. But Oliver, I wanted to check in with you if there's any more news on the 12 constituencies, 12 police forces asking the Crown Prosecution Service to consider charges over general election expenses. I mean, that issue is still going on. The CBS said it received files looking into those election expenses and the way that the Conservative battle bus visits to constituencies were recorded in campaign spending returns. That issue is still there, isn't it?
Well, I think all of the MPs concerned are absolutely clear that they've complied with all of the rules. I know that Central Office is supporting them very strongly in that, and I'm sure they'll be vindicated.
I guess, you know, we'll all be looking at election expenses again and making sure that this time everything is done by the book.
Wasn't it 30 MPs? It was
12 police forces.
It was 30 people, but they're not necessarily all MPs.
Yeah.
And they're not all necessarily going to be charged either, obviously.
And 12 areas, yes, indeed. So the investigations
Well, we
continue.
Don't know, do we yet?
We will see.
Well, they're pretty sure they'll be vindicated, so let's not prejudge it.
We don't know. Yeah, exactly. Well, you just have. But let's not prejudge it.
Sam, let's have a look at the front pages. What do we got?
Well, let's start with the Times. What a good newspaper. May renews threat to walk away from EU without a deal. This weekend, we saw the European Union decide how they were going to approach the British negotiation with the UK vis-a-vis Brexit. This is the biggest thing that this country is going to do during the parliament to which we are having the election for right now. And just at the moment, the rhetoric isn't great from either side, pretty much. What we heard today was Theresa May being pretty hardline, claiming, a lot of people don't believe her, that you can get a trade deal done in 2 years, repeating, in a way that a lot of people didn't want her to, that walking away is an option that she will deploy if Britain is offered a bad deal. She's raising the temperature. Over in Brussels, they're raising the temperature. This doesn't bode terribly well, but there's a long way to go.
Because they're saying no trade discussions until there's agreement on what's paid in severance payments.
Not quite agreement until substantial progress has been made. That's a dancing on the head of the pin, but it's quite an important pin.
But still at the top of the list as well is the rights of EU nationals and this question of a hard border in Northern Ireland.
The really interesting question is, who does Brussels think it's negotiating with? Is it Theresa May? Is it Nick Timothy, her chief of staff? Is it David Davis? Is it Ollie Robbins, the top Mandarin? There's a lot of confusion in Brussels about just how this negotiation's going to be conducted. There's a lot left to learn, and we're probably not going to learn it in this election campaign. Right, next, Daily Mirror. Blair, I'm back. I'm going to hold this up. Two thumbs up, Emily. What do you think? Are we pleased that Blair's back in the election campaign? He is saying to the Mirror, you need to get your hands dirty. I'm going to take part in the active part in shaping the policy debate. I'm not getting much of a smile. No smile, no smile.
He keeps saying he's coming back. So he seems to be back again.
You look pleased, finally. Thank goodness. The Daily Telegraph. Facebook must play to police the internet. That's the splash in the Times as well. You've got a big report from the Home Affairs Select Committee denouncing Twitter, Google, Facebook for not doing enough. You've seen a big investigation in the Times. It seems to be fairly similar to the kind of things that we've been pulling up. But down the bottom, we've got the main political story. Theresa May pledge on VAT, but not income tax. Speaking to Andrew Marr this morning, speaking to Robert Peston this morning, she said that she would not raise VAT in this election. Which begs the question whether or not she'll allow income tax or national insurance to go up. She's got a pledge not to that she claims that she wants to reduce tax on working families. We don't have the definition of what working families are. So who does that mean? And could the other taxes go up?
Well, these are the questions that we were trying to get into earlier and we will pursue in coming weeks. I have to stop everyone there. That's all we've got time for tonight. Thanks to all my guests, Sam Coates, Professor Philip Cowley, Emily Thornbury and Oliver Dowden. Join me again next time, same time next week. For now, from all of us here at the Westminster Hour, good night.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.